Based on newly released papers and interviews with family members, friends and colleagues, Jeff Andrews shatters the myths surrounding John Carecross's wartime espionage, the so-called fifth man of the Cambridge Spy Circle. He's written it in a book called Agent Moliere, The Life of John Carecross, the Fifth Man of the Cambridge Spy Circle. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Jeff Andrews, good morning to you, Jeff.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about the background of who the Cambridge Five were.
Well, the four of them, much better known than John Carecross. They were quite affluent backgrounds, upper middle class. Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, Anthony Blunt. A lot more is known about them, a lot more biographies they feature in, you know, dramatizations. Less is known about John Carecross, who had quite a different social background. He's from a low middle class family in Scotland. He didn't have the same social connections, let's say, as the other members of the Cambridge Five. And I wrote the book really because his life has been a bit of a mystery, and in many ways he's been misrepresented. Some people would have seen the film The Imitation Game, where he's played by one of the Downton Abbey actors, in a rather spurious representation of him blackmailing Alan Turing, somebody, in fact, he never met. So one of the things I wanted to do when I saw the papers was to present a slightly different, more nuanced picture of John Carecross. And one of the things that struck me when I was doing the book was it was an original diary he kept in 1932, when at the age of 19 he went on a cycling trip around Germany and Austria and saw at first hand the rise of Hitler. And this, in a way, opened his mind, you know, as a young person in search of principles to live by, to the horrors of fascism. And that put him on the road to doing something about it. Unfortunately, of course, it led him to quite a fateful decision to become a spy. But that picture of him as a young man influenced by the rise of Hitler hasn't really been properly discussed in previous accounts of his life.
And what was the, you know, because the 1930s, the early 1930s, was, if first, it was two ideologies really clashing, wasn't it? You had Nazism and National Socialism and Communism. And, you know, a lot of young men, especially at the universities, were captured by the idealism. You know, we had later on, we had the Spanish Civil War, of course.
Exactly. One of the things about Carecross which differs from the other four was he wasn't ideologically converted to communism at Cambridge. In fact, he wasn't really a communist at all. When he joined, like many others, the communist group. In fact, when he arrived at Cambridge in 1934, three of the other four Cambridge spies had already left, had already graduated, and only Anthony Blunt was there. But a key part of Carecross's life was starting at the Foreign Office and finding himself in the Spanish section of the Foreign Office once the Spanish Civil War was underway. Now, he had sympathies with the Republican side. Of course, the British government and the opposition had a position of non-intervention, which meant that in the office, he was quite outspoken and regarded by colleagues as troublesome. And that was also, I think, quite significant in his frustration of not being able to do anything about it. He was seeing reports coming back from Spain, was noting in his annotated comments, you know, this man is a fascist and so on, but wasn't able to project that position. Didn't find any allies in the Foreign Office. And indeed, when the Munich Agreement happened in 1938, when Chamberlain met Hitler and came to this agreement and what we know as appeasement, Carecross was actually in the German section, dealing with the Foreign Office section, dealing with Germany. So he saw again at first hand the prospect of war and was frustrated by not being able to do anything about it in his view. And it was in this period in 1937 that he was recruited to Soviet intelligence, given the codename Moliere, which of course was interesting because later on he became quite a distinguished scholar of Moliere, was already interested in French literature. But then, like all the others, you know, led a life of secrecy and a life which was compartmentalized between his spying, his scholarship, and other aspects of his life.
He had a different background, didn't he, as well, to the rest of the Cambridge Five? I mean, he was from working-class background?
He was from a lower-middle-class background, I would say. I mean, he wasn't a working-class background as such. He wasn't, for example, a Clydeside militant, as some have suggested. He came from the Clyde Valley. His father was an ironmonger. It was a highbrow family. There were, he had seven siblings, and two of them became professors. He himself became a professor, and later in life, after he had moved to Rome in the wake of the he had to resign from the Treasury in the wake of the Burgess and Maclean disappearance in 1952. He moved to Rome and was able to do a bit more scholarship, get on with his writing, and just before his confession in 1964, he was made Professor of Romance Languages at Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. So he did, you know, was a scholar as well as a spy, but was certainly regarded, I think, detrimentally, certainly in comparison to the other members of the Cambridge spying, because of this different social background. He didn't fit easily into the circles of the Foreign Office and the Civil Service. You know, he was regarded as irascible and difficult, awkward to get on with. He didn't progress in the Foreign Office. He was moved to different sections. And at the time he had to resign, in the diaries of Guy Liddell, who was the deputy director of MI5, you can see the way in which Cancross is treated, really. I mean, Liddell found it difficult to believe that his friend Anthony Blunt, for example, could be a spy, whereas he's much more likely to believe that somebody from Cancross's background was a spy. So I think the social background factor is important. And he was Scottish, and he saw, you know, what we now call the establishment as being dominated by peculiarly English class characteristics, which he didn't fit into.
I mean, you could say he was fertile ground to be recruited, because if you think about it, coming from a bit different background, you know, he's not happy. He doesn't fit in at Cambridge. He doesn't fit in at Whitehall. And he also sees, I mean, the Spanish, the defeats of the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War was obviously a crushing blow for a lot of young men's ideologies. So who made the original approach to him? Was it Blunt?
Well, yes, there was an initial approach from Blunt and Burgess at a meeting in Cambridge and subsequently in Paris, but that didn't work. And so they got James Klugman, who was the leader of the communists at Cambridge, who was a Communist Party member and a friend of Cancross. They had the same tutor to help in his recruitment. It was a classic sort of John le Carré scene at Regent's Park, where Klugman sort of pushed him, left him in the company of his controller, who was quite interesting, Austrian, Arnold Deutsch, known as Otto, cosmopolitan, Austrian Jewish background, and no doubt Cancross could have told him a bit about his cycling journey to Germany and Austria in 1932. And so he was recruited on the basis of making a contribution against fascism, and that was how all the spies were recruited, really, on that basis. But as I say, he wasn't an ideological communist. I mean, Burgess himself didn't regard Cancross as a real communist. He saw him as a sort of bourgeois individualist. And Burgess also regarded Cancross, as he put it, as not really one cannot call him a gentleman. You can sort of see the sort of class divide between the spies. But Cancross made that decision. Once you're recruited, of course, it's difficult to extricate yourself from that situation. And that, you know, that continued really right up until the time of his resignation in 1952. His biggest contribution, I suppose, as far as espionage is concerned, was when working at Bletchley Park. He passed on details which led to the Soviet victory at the Battle of Kursk, quite a decisive victory in the Second World War. Of course, the Soviets were an ally at that time, and Cancross always justified his espionage on that basis. That became more difficult when the Cold War started, and he was still resumed his spying after 1945, in fact, from sort of 1948 until he had to leave the country. So for him, he wasn't somebody who wanted to bring down the Western system, let's say. He was, in fact, I would describe, because of his literary and other interests and his later life in Rome, he was somebody who was intellectually, emotionally, culturally immersed in Western society, perhaps unlike the others who were much more of a sort of orthodox Marxist disposition.
Did he erase suspicion when he was at Bletchley Park? I mean, how did he stay, if you like, under the radar for so long?
That's quite a good question. I mean, he obviously took a risk, but the security wasn't very tight. He would smuggle the documents in his trousers out of Bletchley Park, you know, put them in a bag at Bletchley Station, travel to London, pass them on to his controller. They didn't really have much suspicion of him. And the strange thing about Cancross is he had no knowledge he was in a ring. So in other words, although he knew the others, he didn't know they were spies, whereas the other four were friends, and some of them were Cambridge contemporaries. That's quite an odd thing. He only came under suspicion during the investigation into the disappearance of Guy Burgess and Donald Maclean, when documents in his handwriting were found in Guy Burgess's belongings. I mean, there were discussions about appeasement at the time of Munich. That was enough to bring suspicion, bring to the attention of MI5, who then followed him but couldn't find any conclusive proof of his espionage. But he had to resign on that basis in 1952. He then went to Rome and rebuilt his life, really, never escaping from the threat of being exposed, as indeed he was in 1979 and then in 1990.
But if you think about it, why did the Soviet Union let him go, though? I mean, had he served his purpose? I mean, you know, other spies like McLean and Burgess, escaped to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it was. I think for them it was quite risky. I think probably he had served his purpose in the sense that the material he passed on to them after 1948 wasn't of the same quality of material he was passing on to them when he was at Bletchley Park. So in a sense, I think when Burgess and McLean disappeared, obviously that was really a big moment. And of course, the whole Cambridge spy thing then started to fall apart later with, you know, Kim Philby leaving in the early 60s and coming under suspicion long before that. And so there wasn't really much future in it for them. For him, I mean, he tried to leave before that. He was in a slightly difficult position because, perhaps unlike the others, he wasn't going to get a sympathetic hearing from Foreign Office and civil service colleagues with whom he didn't get on in any case. And so trying to find a way out was difficult. He applied for academic jobs, had Lord Hankey and Graham Greene as his referees, but didn't get anywhere until much later, you know, when he had publications. So it was a difficult situation, I suppose, from his position. He had also the question of self-preservation, that he had to look after his own interests, and kept, as I say, this completely secret life. He kept it secret from his wife, from his family. At that time, nobody else knew about his espionage. And when he left, he presented as a case of looking for a new career and moving to Italy, you know, to find it.
And he had a long-term friendship, with the writer, the spy writer, Graham Greene.
That's right. This is quite interesting. It was the most important friendship for Cancross, really, because Greene was, who he met in MI6, was a friend. He was also a mentor in many ways. He was an academic referee. He was somebody he turned to for advice, whether it was advice about his research, his publications, or indeed, once he'd been exposed, he was looking for advice on how to deal with the press and you know, as an exposed spy. And so Greene was important. He was somebody he always looked up to. And you can see a long correspondence between him and Greene that included the sort of different aspects of Cancross's life. On the one hand, you know, talking about literary matters, then going off about his financial uncertainties, and then on later in life, asking for advice on what to do with the media once they got hold of his spying. So it was a significant friendship for him, really.
And how devastating was being exposed, as I said, in the late 70s? I mean, did his life fall apart at that point, or did he manage to sort of quietly fade? Well, I suppose you could say he faded into obscurity, because again, it was a name that doesn't spring to mind when you think of the Cambridge Five.
Yeah, quite interesting. His first exposure in 1979 came when the Sunday Times sent two of their reporters on his trail, and they didn't find everything. And it wasn't like, I think, the second exposure in 1990, by which time he'd moved to France. But it's also true to say he didn't lose any significant friendships when he became exposed. I think in Italy, people live and let live. You know, they were more curious, you know, how interesting, we've got a spy among us. So he wasn't really facing that kind of intense scrutiny he would have had in the UK. I mean, his life didn't fall apart, really. I mean, it's quite interesting. He managed to sort of carry on with his life. And as I say, he continued to publish he'd done earlier work for the BBC, and his dramatizations of Racine, who was previously regarded as untranslatable, reached Radio 3 and Radio 4 and the London Edinburgh theatres in the late 60s and early 70s. So he was able to see that. He wasn't actually able to return to the UK to visit the rehearsals, but he was able to see his work come to some fruition. I should say that his life was also made more uncertain by the attitude of MI5 towards him. Blunt, who confessed in 1964, shortly after Cancross, he was then, Anthony Blunt was then the surveyor of the Queen's pictures. He was given immunity from prosecution. Cairngorms was never given the same immunity. He was allowed to return to the UK if he agreed to cooperate with MI5. And so his life remained uncertain and precarious, perhaps, on that basis. But he didn't have a breakdown. He didn't turn to drink like the others. He managed to negotiate the different aspects of his life. And then later in life, he met his second wife, who was much younger than him, and that led to a kind of renaissance. You know, she influenced him. He took up, resumed, you know, his circles in Rome with a younger group. He led quite a nice lifestyle in Rome, convivial dinners with like-minded people. Quite a different character, really, to the one we think about in his early years in the civil service. He was less, if you like, prickly and much more open and a lover of life, really.
I mean, it's interesting because you say that, you know, Blunt, establishment purveyor of the Queen's pictures, etc. He gets immunity prosecution, whereas as Cairncross, as you said, bit of an outsider, not from the same background, doesn't. So even with espionage, there's an old boy network in operation.
That's right. He certainly felt like that. I mean, that was, he thought there was an establishment, I would say, conspiracy. I mean, I don't go the whole way with that, but certainly he was treated differently. He thought MI5 threw him to the wolves, really, because they had agreed to bring him back. He was cooperating with them. He was trying to get, for example, James Klugman to confess in a meeting with him, to own up to his own espionage. So he was cooperating with them. And then when he was publicly exposed, he felt they didn't do much to protect him. You know, he didn't end that uncertainty. And yes, he did resent Blunt, because obviously Blunt had quite a distinguished academic career and was allowed to carry on with it until 1979. So there was certainly a feeling on Cairncross's part that he was mistreated in comparison to the others.
Having said that, there's a lot to be said for having convenient, as you said, having convivial dinners with like-minded people in Rome than perhaps the other ones who are sitting sort of quietly going bananas in crumbling Soviet-era blocks somewhere in Moscow.
Yes, that's definitely true. I mean, I think that's obviously right. And as I say, he did rebuild his life to a large extent, and even at the most critical times, he was able to still continue with his research. He would continue working on his translations, really, right up until he had his strokes later in life. So he was able to carry on as a scholar, if you like, and despite his exposure as a spy.
So talking about research, where did you start your research? I believe there's some papers that were released.
Yeah, I came onto this, really, because I'd written a biography with James Klugman, who was the person who'd recruited Cairncross. And at the end of that, I met John Cairncross's second wife, who's younger than him. And she made available his papers, which are held now in Cambridge University Library. And I looked at the Graham Greene correspondence. And his brother, Alec Cairncross, who was a very distinguished economist, and was actually chief economic advisor to the government at the time that John Cairncross confessed in 1964. And Alec Cairncross has vast amount of papers held at Glasgow University. And so, you know, decision you make at the beginning of a project like this is whether there's enough there to do the book, and whether there's an interesting story. And I felt that looking at the papers, you know, there was much of John Cairncross's life hadn't been told before, certainly not in this way. And as I said, there was a different picture of him, really, that ought to be brought to public attention.
And you spoke with surviving members of his family, his nephews, his nieces. I mean, what's their attitude to their famous stroke, infamous relation? I mean, a lot, obviously, if you're related to Philby or Blunt, there's a certain amount of, if you like, shame because of what they did. Are they perhaps a bit more ambivalent to John Cairncross?
Yes, I mean, I think they generally sympathetic to him and feel that he was badly treated. Alec Cairncross, towards the end of his life, wrote his own autobiography with a last section, a sort of appendix, if you like, where he defended his brother. And the family likewise felt he's been badly treated. He did actually a Newsnight interview in 1990 with Peter Snow when he'd been exposed as the fifth man, and you can find quite easily, but he comes across then as this sort of scholarly academic, not really able to answer a straight question, looks quite evasive. Some family members felt he probably should have left it, not, you know, contributed to more public attention. Others felt he was right to give his side of the story. His niece, Frances Cancross, who economist, broadcaster, led the Cancross review into the future of journalism, did a Radio 4 program with Stella Rimington, the former director of MI5. And while Frances was quite critical of her uncle's decision to carry on spying after 1945, was aghast at Stella Rimington's suggestion that he should be equated with, you know, with those who wanted to bring down Western civilization. Because, as I said before, he was deeply immersed in its history and culture. So generally, the family felt he was badly treated. I also tracked down former friends and colleagues of his in Rome, because he worked for the Food and Agriculture Organization for a long time, was doing policy briefings as well as his translations and a bit of writing as a journalist for The Economist. And they also told me about his life in Rome, and didn't affect the friendships at all, and were keen that his side of the story, if you like, was told.
So what do you think, what do you hope that people will take out of your book, Asia Moliere?
Well, I hope they'll look at his life in a different way, perhaps also consider the historical context of the 1930s and the kind of decisions that people at that time had to make. They made mistakes as well, but they were an idealistic generation. I think that, as I say, the previous representations of Cairncross suggest he was rather duped by Anthony Blunt and others. But in fact, he'd been a student for 4 years before he reached Cambridge. And I think that he was somebody who was very independently minded, some would say perhaps arrogant in thinking he knew better. But there was an international crisis at the time, you know, over various things. There was a big economic depression. The whole appeasement issue was a dividing point in British politics. And, you know, people took different positions. They made unwise choices in some cases. But I think that to look at his life as a whole, you know, not just the particular moment where he made that decision, but to try and place his life in a wider context, both the events leading up to his decision, when as a 19-year-old he travelled around Europe, but also his subsequent life, you know, where he rebuilt his life and made a contribution as a writer and a scholar.
The book is called Asia Moliere, The Life of John Cairncross, the Fifth Man in the Cambridge Spy Circle. It's out now. It's by Jeff Andrews. Jeff, if people want to find out more information about you or about the book, is there a website? Can they find you on social media?
I'm on Twitter at Andrews Jeff. The publishers have all the details about the book at bloomsby.com, probably the best place to go.
And you'll be able to download it as well from the TRE Virtual Bookshop. Only begs the question, after delving into the Cambridge spy circle, what's next in your sights?
I'm doing something completely different now. I'm going to write about a Welsh journalist who was a BBC broadcaster during the war, and also a politician who had to face, from a different position, the threat of Britain going to war. His name is Cyril Lakin. He's a distant relative of mine, and I'm currently looking at his papers. So the Cambridge Spies was fascinating, but at some point you've got to move on to something else.
This book is called Asia Moliere. It's by Jeff Andrews. Jeff, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure.